Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, who talks about the need for a new U.S. relationship with Israel after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's repudiation of an independent Palestinian state. Lindsay Kashgarian, research director with the National Priorities Project, who discusses the Republican and White House push for big increases in military spending in the current congressional budget debate. And Dave Johnson, a fellow with the Campaign for America's Future, who reviews the Republican Party's proposed budget cuts and the contrasting Congressional Progressive Caucus People's Budget, which addresses growing income inequality. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A day after a million people filled the streets of Brazilian cities in anti-government protests, prosecutors charged the treasurer of the ruling Workers' Party, João Vacari, and 28 others with receiving kickbacks from Petrobras, the state oil company and its related contractors. The Petrobras corruption scandal has shaken the foundation of Brazil's political establishment. The two leaders of the national legislature are under investigation, as is President Dilma Rousseff's former chief of staff. At the time when the corruption was taking place, Rousseff led Petrobras's board of directors. Prosecutors filed criminal charges and indicted executives of key Petrobras contractor companies in December. The corruption investigation, known as Operation Car Wash, has focused on the illicit transfer of $21 million between accounts managed in Switzerland and Monaco. President Rousseff, who was re-elected in October, now faces a resurgent right-wing opposition which is demanding her impeachment. A standoff between students and riot police turned violent in Myanmar in mid-March as police used batons to break up a protest march opposing a new education law. Police detained 120 students and journalists, and the action was condemned by the United States and European Union and raised international concerns about how deeply Myanmar's new regime is committed to democracy. The student-led Action Committee for Democratic Education condemned the new education law for its strict control of all aspects of university life. The group's manifesto calls for the establishment of student unions, freedom to study Burma's diverse ethnic languages, and increased funding for education. Although the government released some of the detained student activists, it blamed the protesters for the violence, provoking criticism from the National League of Democracy, led by Aung San Suu Kyi, winner of the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize. Human Rights Watch blasted the Myanmar police for using excessive force against protesters and using plainclothes undercover officers, asserting that this marks an ugly return to the street violence of military rule. Before the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City, which together sparked months of protest and the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement, the U.S. Department of Justice knew they had a problem. Top data crunchers concluded they could not adequately count the number of police killings across the country each year. According to the Guardian newspaper, while a special team inside the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics had for years collected data on police arrest-related deaths, three states failed to provide any statistics, and 13 other states gave incomplete and inconsistent data on arrest-related deaths. DOJ statisticians, who were uncomfortable with the reliability of the annual total number of police killings, decided to close down the project in March 2014. But last December, President Obama signed a renewal of the Deaths in Custody Reporting Act, which was created to monitor deaths in prisons and jails, but which also mandates that the Justice Department count arrest-related deaths. The new law might resurrect the counting program in enlarged form, with new funding and support. Some observers find the government's failure to track officer-involved homicides especially problematic because it appears to be part of the institutional racism meted out to African Americans by the U.S. criminal justice system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
U.S.-Israeli relations hit a new low after a series of actions taken by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the lead-up to a successful re-election campaign. The Israeli leader's breach of protocol in not informing the White House about the Republican Party's invitation to address a joint session of Congress in early March was followed by the speech itself, where he called on members of Congress to reject any agreement that President Obama may secure in international talks with Iran over its nuclear program. Netanyahu's meddling in U.S. domestic politics caused a major backlash that was later eclipsed by his controversial statements in Israel just before his nation's March 17th parliamentary elections. Concerned about slipping poll numbers, Netanyahu appealed to his right-wing base by stating he would reject the establishment of an independent Palestinian state as long as he was prime minister, upending a cornerstone of U.S.-Israel policy for decades. He further inflamed tensions with the Obama administration and much of the world when, on election eve, he expressed alarm that Arab-Israeli citizens were being bused to the polling stations in droves by left-wing organizations. The latest friction point came a week after the election, when the Wall Street Journal published a story that claimed Netanyahu's government had spied on international negotiations with Iran, then leaked that information to U.S. legislators in order to undermine a future nuclear deal. Your reporter spoke with Josh Rubner, policy director with the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, who talks about the need for a new U.S. relationship with Israel after Prime Minister Netanyahu's repudiation of the two-state solution.
Well, I think we've finally arrived at a point where everybody is in agreement that the premise for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian issue that has held for so long is no longer tenable. And that is a so-called two-state resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. For the first time, you have senior, both U.S. and Israeli figures agreeing that there is not going to be a Palestinian state. Now, when I talk about the U.S. side, we know about Netanyahu on the Israeli side. But when I talk about the U.S. side, 2 years ago, Secretary of State John Kerry testified to Congress that there existed at most a two-year window of opportunity for establishing a Palestinian state because of Israel's relentless colonization of this Palestinian land that's been under military occupation for now nearly half a century. John Kerry understood that there simply would be no contiguous base of land left on which to establish a Palestinian state. So you have both senior U.S. and Israeli figures saying that this two-state resolution is not going to happen. And I think that this provides a lot of clarity, actually, in terms of how to move forward, in terms of thinking beyond this stale, discredited peace process that has not resulted and will not result in a sovereign Palestinian state. And this opens new doors, new windows of opportunity for thinking creatively about how Palestinians and Israeli Jews can finally resolve their issues with justice, freedom, and equality for the Palestinian people.
Now, after the Israeli elections, President Obama said that his administration would reevaluate U.S. policy towards Israel. We don't really know what that means right now. There's a lot of people guessing that the United States could take a different position in the United Nations when it comes to moves towards recognizing some Palestinian state in the near term. What do you think are the opportunities here and the likelihood that the Obama administration will move in a dramatically new direction, since Benjamin Netanyahu basically said that during his term as prime minister, he will not abide by a Palestinian state, although he's tried to walk that statement back a little bit since he won election?
Well, I think clearly for the Obama administration to really reassess the U.S.-Israel relationship, the Obama administration seriously needs to think about implementing sanctions against Israel. There is a whole history of U.S. presidents who have acted tough toward Israel when Israel did not get in line with U.S. foreign policy objectives. And it goes back to President Eisenhower, through Ford, through Reagan, up to Bush Sr. All of them imposed sanctions and real cost against Israel when Israel was being intransigent and blocking U.S. attempts to advance peace in the region. Now, unfortunately, sanctions have not been on the table from the Obama administration for the past 6 years. I hope that they will seriously consider them. And even short of ending U.S. military aid to Israel, which totals more than $3 billion a year, which I don't think is really politically feasible for the Obama administration to do, there's a number of lesser sanctions and lesser steps that the administration could take to really amp up the pressure on Israel and get it moving in the direction that it needs to go in order for peace to be established in the region. So this includes slowing down the transfer of weapons, holding Israel accountable for using particular weapons to commit human rights abuses in violation of the Arms Export Control Act, and making sure those weapons aren't delivered to Israel anymore, shutting down the 501c3 quote-unquote charitable organizations in the United States, which funnel tens of millions of dollars to the construction of Israeli settlements every year. There are many of these types of things that the Obama administration could do to really ratchet up the pressure on Israel, and which I think it desperately needs to do if it has any hope of moving this issue forward in its remaining 2 years in office.
Josh, what's the future of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement around the world, given the results of this election and Benjamin Netanyahu's going on the record saying that he would stand in the way of establishing an independent Palestinian state?
Well, I think the outcome is going to be quite clear. I think these campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which are called for by Palestinian civil society, more than 170 groups are calling on people of conscience to engage in these campaigns. I think that these campaigns will greatly intensify. I think it will be incredibly even more difficult for defenders of Israel's apartheid regime to defend Israel in this new era. And in fact, I think even before the election, the discourse, the debate had already been lost to Israel's supporters. And in fact, almost every time you have a resolution on divestment or on boycott, there are huge efforts by the Israel lobby to suppress the debate and the vote from even happening in the first place, because the Israel lobby knows very well that if there's an open discussion and open debates on the merits of whether Israel should be boycotted or divested from, the proponents of those resolutions win almost every time, which is why they have to go for this mechanism to try to silence any dissent. But it's getting harder and harder to do in this day and age. And Netanyahu's election makes our job advocating for these campaigns much more easy.
That was Josh Rubner, policy director with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. He's author of the book titled Shattered Hopes, The Failure of Obama's Middle East Peace Process. Find more analysis and commentary on U.S.-Israeli relations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the budget process works its way through the federal government, President Obama's proposed budget, as well as the Republican House and Senate proposals, all increase military spending, some more drastically than others. Meanwhile, domestic spending stands to take a big hit, especially in the House proposal. The House Budget Committee has proposed dramatic domestic spending cuts, similar to those put forward last year by 2012 GOP vice presidential candidate, Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan. The only budget that differs significantly is that of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. That's the subject of another interview in this week's program. The House and Senate are due to vote before the end of March on the respective budgets, which then must be reconciled before they can pass 12 separate appropriation bills to send to the president. But there's disagreement between Republican fiscal conservatives calling for spending cuts and defense hawks seeking more money for the Pentagon. President Obama is expected to veto any reconciliation bills that reaches his desk, setting up the need for continuing budget resolutions and the threat of a government shutdown this fall. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Lindsay Kashgarian, research director with the National Priorities Project based in Western Massachusetts. Here she explains the loophole that allows for big increases in military expenditures despite spending caps imposed by sequestration, and points to the budget proposal most in keeping with what Americans say their priorities are.
You asked about the sequestration spending levels. The president's Pentagon proposal and military spending proposal overall broke those limits. So under current law, it would result in sequestration, which is these sort of across-the-board blind spending slashes that no one has really wanted to see, that no one really believes is good policy. But the president proposes getting rid of those caps so that he could spend higher, and in fact proposed a $534 billion base budget for the Pentagon, which would be the highest base budget that the Pentagon has ever had in our history. Now, on top of that, he also proposed $51 billion in war funding for the Pentagon, and that is money that is not subject to the budget caps. That's money that is sort of off the books, and it has been a way that Congress and the president have sidestepped the spending caps on the defense side for the last several years.
When you say war budget, with wars in so many places, what is that for? What does it cover?
So it's a specific fund. Its official name is Overseas Contingency Operations, and it was established really to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, those wars, the Iraq war has largely wound down. The war in Afghanistan is supposed to be winding down this year, but the budget has stayed high. That's partly because the Pentagon has been using those funds to fill in gaps where it couldn't get funds in its base budget. So while the president has proposed $51 billion in that fund for 2016, the House proposed up to $90 billion, and the Senate proposed $58 billion. So all of them are using this fund as a way to get around the caps on spending that would apply to the Pentagon's base budget.
So, Lindsay Kashgarian, what would be the impact of this part of the budget on the rest of the budget?
Well, one thing that's happening, the caps were supposed to relate to both defense and non-defense spending. Now, the non-defense portion of the caps are still very much in play and have been in place over the last few years because there is no non-defense version of this war fund. There's no off-the-books fund for domestic spending that's not for the Pentagon. So, yes, domestic spending is definitely suffering by comparison, although the extent to which that is true is very different among the different budgets. The president's budget would propose an additional $178 billion over 10 years in domestic spending. So he proposes getting rid of those caps. The House and Senate budgets both would not only keep the caps in place for domestic spending that's not for the Pentagon, but they would actually cut that spending even more. The House would cut that spending by an additional $759 billion over the next 10 years.
The Republicans always want to cut taxes. Are they cutting taxes, cutting social programs, and increasing Pentagon spending all at the same time?
They are proposing that, although what's interesting about the House and Senate proposals, unlike the president's proposal, which is very detailed in its tax proposals, the House and Senate proposals for taxes are both very light on details. So they both call for overhaul of the tax code, but they don't really say exactly what they would do or even come close. You know, Americans say that they want spending on these domestic programs. When you look at polling, you know, they want the Congress and the president to do something about jobs and the economy. They want the president and Congress to do something about education. They want up spending on these programs.
And climate issues too, right? I've read polls that show a majority of Americans would be willing to spend more on reining in climate chaos.
Yes, we've seen some interesting polling lately showing that not only do people believe that climate change is real, but they also want the government to do something about it.
It's a lot to keep track of with all these numbers and all these different budgets.
In our competing visions analysis that we have at our website, we look at four different budgets: the president's, the House budget, the Senate budget, and the Congressional Progressive Caucus budget. And we also looked at them compared to polling of what Americans say they want the government to do. And when you stack those things up and look at which budget seems to best match the priorities that Americans say they have for the government, things like prioritizing jobs in the economy, prioritizing education, prioritizing Social Security, the Congressional Progressive Caucus budget actually seems to be the best match for what Americans say they want.
That was Lindsay Kashgarian, Research Director with the National Priorities Project. Find more news and commentary on U.S. military spending by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Republicans who won a majority in the U.S. Senate last November are currently debating the 2016 federal budget, their first since taking control of Congress. GOP proposed budgets would cut about $5 trillion over the next 10 years, with programs that assist working families hit the hardest. Programs targeted for major reductions include Medicare and Medicaid, college tuition, job training, medical research, and rebuilding the nation's infrastructure. Both the Senate and House budgets would repeal the Obamacare health plan that now provides health insurance to more than 16 million people and would force 11 million people off the food stamps program known as SNAP. Competing Republican budget proposals differ on how deeply to cut social programs and the amount of increased funding that should be allocated to the Pentagon. While the rationale for major spending cuts is advertised as a path to balancing the federal budget, the House budget plan would give larger tax cuts to the wealthy, which the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities estimates would create a $1 trillion deficit over the next decade. While the GOP and President Obama's budget blueprints are getting most of the attention in Washington, the Congressional Progressive Caucus has proposed their own set of numbers. The People's Budget, as the caucus calls it, would invest funds to create millions of new jobs, repair crumbling roads and bridges, make college tuition more affordable, improve education, and move the country toward full employment. Money for these funding increases would be generated by raising taxes on wealthy households and large corporations through the elimination of loopholes and establishing fairer tax rates. Your reporter spoke with Dave Johnson, a fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, who reviews the Republican Party's proposed budgets and the contrasting People's Budget, which addresses growing income inequality.
The prior Republican budgets, which of course never got through the Senate, never mind to the president, were huge, massive cuts. They were called the Ryan budget, and then the Republicans adopted them. And they included things like privatizing Medicare and things like that. Those are all in this budget. But then they get rid of Obamacare, of course, which means, you know, millions of people will be without health insurance again. They cut way back on Obamacare's extensions of Medicare, millions more people. They turn Medicare into block grants. I could go down the list of things they do, but to summarize it, it's just dramatic, dramatic, dramatic cuts in government. Republicans don't believe in government. They believe that government is what they call in the way of business, and they mean it. And what we'll have now is a series of these budgets will pass, and Obama will veto them, and we will hope that some kind of compromise comes along with what's called a continuing resolution, where they just, okay, we'll agree, we'll just keep funding it the way it is. Of course, the way it is dramatic cuts, so that's what's coming.
Well, Dave, you wrote about the People's Budget put forward by the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Summarize for us, if you would, the important things to know about the People's Budget.
Okay, sure. The Congressional Progressive Caucus is, I think, the largest caucus group of Democrats in the House. They have been putting forward budgets for several years that they call the People's Budgets. Now, these budgets get no attention from the main media at all. Literally, they don't have any mainstream, you might call them, you know, major media outlet reporters even show up to their press conferences on these budgets. But the budgets are, for people like me who come from a more progressive side, they're actually kind of amazing because they do all of the things that we would want. For example, the progressive budget provides $1.5 trillion for domestic investment above the sequester. So they're adding $1.5 trillion, and that's to do things like rehire teachers that have been laid off, to rehire police, fire, and a big one is infrastructure. They're going to put a lot of money into fixing our infrastructure, fixing those horrible roads, our ports, our airports, the rail systems, the water systems, the dams, all of these things that we see, especially the bridges that are falling apart. 8.4 million good-paying jobs that would create by 2018. And this is a real budget. It really would. A couple of different economic think tanks have looked at this, like the Economic Policy Institute and others, and analyzed it, that if you spend that much money on infrastructure, you do get that many jobs. And we know how many teachers and police and everything have been laid off. This is real. They do it by telling corporations, for example, to bring back that money they've got parked overseas. That is a huge, huge amount of money right there. If they bring, it's like $2.1 trillion that they bring back. That's taxable at 35%. Minus, you know, there's the minuses of whatever, like if they pay taxes somewhere else, but they're usually parked in low tax places. They bring in some new brackets on upper incomes. They add a new bracket at $1 million, another one at $10 million, another one at $100 million, and another one at $1 billion, adding just one percentage point on each. At, I think it was $1 billion, they have a 49% tax rate. Now, that means that hedge fund managers, you got to feel sorry for them. If they make $2 billion in a year, they'll only get to keep $1 billion take home that year. But, you know, you got to feel sorry for them. But still, that's a lot of money that then we get.
Dave, when we look at income inequality, which has certainly become a bigger and bigger issue over the years with Gilded Age kinds of disparities in wealth in this country. And certainly that was brought to the fore by the Occupy Wall Street movement back in 2011. But even the Republicans now are talking about inequality as an issue leading up to the presidential race in 2016. But of course, the Republican budget here would do nothing but exacerbate inequality, while the people's budget put forward by the Congressional Progressive Caucus would be an antidote. You want to talk about how our media really doesn't seem to be paying attention to the concrete proposals being put forward here and their net effects, you know, in terms of the budget?
Well, you're exactly right. The idea that somehow if you cut taxes, it helps create jobs is pervasive. All the evidence is against it. Number of studies have looked at if you cut taxes, does that create jobs? No. And in fact, if you cut taxes, then what happens is you don't spend money on the things that do create jobs because you don't have it anymore. Education, scientific research, infrastructure. This time they're doing this austerity. The media, as you said, just follows onto that line that, oh, well, government spends too much money and that's the problem. And we get into a mess like we're in.
That was Dave Johnson, a fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. Find links to Dave's recent columns and related articles on the federal budget debate by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.